While the snow had changed the landscape, the Chisholm Wagon Road had been in use for 3 years as a cattle trail and would be well-defined. It would lead them south to the Red River, and crossing that, they would be less than an hour from Dallas or Fort Worth.
Where are we going?
Fort Worth, Texas. I need some sleep and some hot food, and you need some clothes and boots that fit. Time enough to get you back to Kansas after El Gato and his bunch have returned to Indian territory.
Well, I'm not going back to Kansas.
You have kin somewhere else, I reckon?
None that I claim. Ma and Pa married against the wishes of her family and his. Now they're all dead. Them that's left, aunts, uncles, cousins, I don't know them. I don't know where they are, and I don't want to know.
Then you have nowhere to go?
Nowhere, unless I go with you.
You can't go with me. It wouldn't be proper. I'm older than you.
Well, Pa was 10 years older than my Ma.
I'm not looking for a wife.
I'm not offering you one. Just tell people we're married. When you get tired of me, I'll go away.
I'm no account, but I'm more of a man than that. Let's just say I have my reason, an almighty good reason, for not wanting a woman riding with me. Can we let it go at that?
Mary said no more, but he had the feeling this wasn't over. He suspected that when her hair was cut and she was dressed decently, Mary Holden was going to be an almighty pretty girl. More temptation than he could resist on a regular basis. Fort Worth, Texas, January 28, 1871. The snow ceased before they reached the Red, and by the time Nathan and Mary rode into Fort Worth, there were patches of bare ground everywhere.
First, we got to report to the post commander, and we'll find you some clothes that fit. Then we're going to find some place where there's a roof over our heads, and I aim to sleep for 2 days.
Nathan asked to speak to the post commander and found Captain Ferguson was still there. He recognized Nathan and seemed somewhat amused at his poorly clothed companion.
We've ridden across Indian territory. We're needing quarters for several nights. I realize this is a military post, Captain, but I'd be glad to pay.
It's not our custom to rent quarters, but in deference to your wife...
Well, she's...
Mary, and we're most obliged, Captain. You are a gentleman.
Ferguson grinned like a mule leading briars, turning him over to a waiting corporal. And he led them to a small cabin that customarily housed a pair of officers at the post's bachelor officer's quarters. The corporal let them in and closed the door, leaving them alone. The room was small, and there was just one bed.
Damn.
You wouldn't have gotten this cabin if it weren't for me.
You can have the bed. I'll spread my blankets on the floor.
You're right. You don't need a wife.
Come on. We'll go to the sutler's and get you some clothes that fit.
Mary Holden was small, and it was difficult to fit her in men's clothes. The man who tried to assist them was at first amused, but he became irritated as the task consumed more and more time. One of the men in the store noticed Nathan's predicament and came over to help.
I'm Lieutenant Masters. My wife's a seamstress. Just buy as close as you can to what you need, and it won't cost that much to have everything altered to fit.
That's most kind of you. Tell me where I can find her.
Here, I'll write it down for you.
He did so, and the embarrassed clerk managed to select shirts and Levi's of a size near enough to Mary's that they could be altered. To Nathan's everlasting relief, the store had wool socks and boots that fit well enough, and while the sleeves on the sheepskin coat were a little long, it would do. They returned to the cabin Ferguson had assigned them, and no sooner had Nathan closed the door than Mary began removing the too large clothing of El Gato.
What the hell are you doing?
Taking off his clothes. I want out of them.
But yours have to be altered.
When I go to have them altered, I'll wear them. You say you need sleep, and I don't feel safe walking around this place alone. I'll wait until you can go with me.
She had already removed the shirt, and when she loosened the belt, the Levi's fell down to her ankles. Despite all his resolutions, Nathan stared at her.
Don't just stand there. Take these boots off.
She sat down on the bed, extending her feet, and he dragged El Gato's boots off. She discarded the Levi's and stretched out on the bed.
Nice bed. More comfortable than the floor.
Nathan had left the horses and the pack saddle at the post livery, and his saddlebags were under the bed. Finally, it occurred to him that he had forgotten old Cotton Blossom. He opened the door a little wary of Mary Holden stretched out on the bed. Cotton Blossom poked his head around the corner of the cabin and started reluctantly for the door. He paused, looked around, decided that the cabin was the lesser of many evils, and came inside. Nathan removed his hat, his gun belt, and then his boots. He stretched out on his back on the other side of the bed, which didn't offer all that much room. When Mary Holden was sure Nathan was asleep, she got up. The clothing to be altered was much nearer her size than that of Elgato's. She sat on the room's only chair and pulled on a pair of the wool socks, and when she looked up, Nathan was looking directly at her.
I thought you were asleep.
Yeah, I'm a light sleeper. Keeps me alive. So where the hell do you think you're going?
I was going to have the clothes fixed.
That can wait. If you don't aim to sleep, then be quiet so I can.
Would you prefer that I sit here, or may I lie on the bed?
If you aim to get up and down, stay where you are.
She sat there for a while. Nathan was sleeping when she again lay down beside him. She wore one of the new shirts and new Levi's.
You forgot the boots.
Mary got up, stomped into the new boots, and lay down again. Nathan had no idea how long he had slept, but when he awakened, the girl's exhaustion had caught up with her, for she was sleeping soundly. Cotton Blossom sat beside the door. Nathan got up and let him out. The sky had cleared and the sun was now on the western horizon. Nathan sat down on the chair, watching Mary Holden sleep. Had she planned to take her clothes to the seamstress, or had she been about to run out on him? He decided she hadn't, for it made no sense. She had no money and her clothes didn't fit. She seemed impulsive, restless, and more than a little put out that he hadn't yielded to temptation and taken her when he had the chance. By her own admission, she had nowhere to go, nowhere she wanted to go, and that fueled the fires of Nathan's suspicion. He had told her he wasn't seeking a wife, and she had denied wishing to become one. But no honest man could take a woman and not feel some obligation to her. He had a strong suspicion she had been counting on that. While he had told her nothing about himself, she was no fool. When he had returned for her, he could have taken her there in Elgato's cabin, making that a condition for his rescue, but he hadn't. He was well-armed, owned not only horse and saddle, but a pack horse as well. He had readily paid for her new clothes, so she was aware that he wasn't poor. He shook his head. Women were a paradox, all too often giving themselves to men who in no way suited their dreams, but could offer some small measure of security. On the other hand, a man, or woman for that matter, who seemed indifferent and unattainable became all the more desirable. Nathan resolved to help Mary Holden in any way that he could, but on his terms, not hers. If somewhere within her lived a woman whose feelings were genuine and whose affection was not for sale or trade, then he would be ready and willing to reconsider. It was the young corporal who had guided them to the cabin.
Captain Ferguson says you and the missus are welcome to eat at the officer's mess. It's the long, low building directly behind the orderly room.
We're obliged, Corporal.
Oh, I'm starved. Where's Cotton Blossom?
Outside. You'd better roll up the legs of those Levi's so you can walk. We'll wait a few minutes before we go for supper. We'll let the soldiers go first. They're doing us a good turn, and I'm not one to take unfair advantage of anyone's hospitality.
When Nathan and Mary reached the officer's mess, they saw Captain Ferguson, who sat at a table near the door, and he nodded to them as they entered. Nathan and Mary filled their trays and took seats at an empty table near where Captain Ferguson sat talking with two other officers. It soon became apparent that one of the officers was the post doctor, and that he and Ferguson were discussing the illness of their telegrapher. Nathan waited for a pause in the conversation.
Captain Ferguson, I couldn't help overhearing your conversation. I was with the Kansas Pacific Railroad for a while, and I know the code. If you're in need of a telegrapher, I'd be glad to fill in until you can make some other arrangements.
Stone, you're the answer to a prayer. Sergeant DeWitt, our telegrapher, is deathly ill, out of his head with a fever. We're authorized to have two telegraphers, but the post is undermanned. The instrument's been clattering all day. By now, Washington probably thinks we've been overrun by Quanah Parker's Comanches. When you've finished eating, please come to my office. The first thing I want you to do is inform Washington that you're a civilian, filling in for the one telegrapher they've sent me in the 4 years I've been post commander here.
Ferguson and the other officers left.
That must have been interesting, working for the railroad.
It was, for a while.
You don't talk much about yourself, do you?
No. I never thought of myself as a conversation piece. I'm a jack of all trades and master of none. I've been a soldier, a gambler, a railroad man, and a deputy U.S. Marshal. I've killed some hombres that was needful of it, and unless somebody salts me down first, I am to kill a few more. I'm not a drinking man, and I don't use tobacco or visit whorehouses. I do sleep with women occasionally, but I'm considering giving that up, because the last three are dead, because of what I did or failed to do. Will that be enough for now?
Yes.
The rest of the meal was eaten in silence. When they had returned to their cabin, Nathan reckoned it was time to visit the seamstress.
Gather up the rest of your clothes. I'll leave you with Mrs. Masters. Have her take up at least one shirt and one pair of Levi's so as you have something to wear. Leave the others, and she can take them up when she gets to them.
The lieutenant's seamstress wife did sewing in the cabin where she lived, and after leaving Mary there, Nathan went to Captain Ferguson's office. Even then, the telegraph was chattering, demanding attention.
Thank God. Find out what that thing wants. It's been driving me to distraction.
Nathan sat down at the table with pencil and paper. Most of the messages were follow-ups to earlier messages, seeking to learn the reason for the lack of response from Fort Worth. Nathan quickly sent a lengthy response from Captain Ferguson detailing the problem. Ferguson had given Nathan credit for aiding him in his emergency. When Washington acknowledged, there was a 5-word message for Nathan.
Silver sends regards to Stone.
Nathan's apparent recognition in Washington didn't go unnoticed by Captain Ferguson.
So it was you who alerted Washington to the, difficulty some months ago at Fort Concho. Silver, Byron Silver?
A friend of mine. I hope your operation that began at Fort Concho worked out to everybody's satisfaction.
Very much so. If it won't inconvenience you, I would consider it a personal favor if you will act as post-telegrapher until I can make other arrangements.
Well, I'd be glad to.
By the time Nathan returned to the Masters' cabin, Mrs. Masters had a pair of Levi's and one of the shirts altered to fit Mary. Nathan and Mary returned to their cabin.
I may be here several more days. I promised the captain I'd remain here as a telegrapher until he makes other arrangements. We'll have our meals and a place to sleep.
After removing his gun belt, his hat, and his boots, he lay down on the bed.
Do you always sleep in your clothes?
When you travel a lot and you don't often have a bed, it helps keep you warm.
There's something unnatural about a man who never takes his clothes off. There's not some of you missing, is there?
He'd caught him off guard, and then he realized she was serious. Angrily, she grabbed the chair, turned it around, and sat down facing the door, her back to him. When he fell asleep, she got up and kicked the chair up against the bed.
What is it?
You! You're impossible! You sleep with your clothes on, you won't talk to me, you won't listen to me! Damn it! I might as well have stayed with El Gato! At least he made me feel like a woman!
Nathan got up and lighted the lamp, for it was dark in the room. He then took her bodily and threw her on the bed. Taking her boots by the heels, he jerked them off her feet. She tried to get up, and he shoved her back down. Unbuttoning her Levi's, he dragged them off. By the time he got to her shirt, he had to fight her to remove that, but he managed it. Then he got up, leaving her lying there.
That's your idea of being treated like a woman, being stripped and having a man salivate, then so be it. I've seen naked women before. When you have something more to offer me than what El Gato could have taken, then maybe you and me will have something to talk about. Meanwhile, you just lie there and feel like a woman.
Nathan sat down in the chair, tipped it back against the wall, and just looked at her. He alternated between feeling sorry for her and wishing he'd never laid eyes on her. Finally, she rolled over and buried her face in a pillow. Even as he was feeling guilty and snake mean, he wondered if she weren't just putting on another act for his benefits. He got up, opened the door, and then closed it as though he'd gone out. But her wailing continued. He rolled her over, but her eyes were closed, and she kept them closed. He kissed her gently on the lips, just once. When she opened her eyes, the anger had been replaced by wonder.
Mary, if you can't get a man's attention without taking off your clothes, then there's something wrong with you. Or with him. You're an almighty pretty girl, but that's not enough. You've been trying to prove something, maybe to me, maybe to yourself, I don't know. Starting right now, I want you to just be you, understand?
I understand. And I'll try.
He got up, blew out the lamp, undressed, and lay down beside her. She remained where she was, unmoving. She was silent for so long, he thought she was sleeping.
Nathan, are you asleep?
Yes, and it's not easy with you talking to me.
Aren't you afraid you'll freeze?
There are times when I like to live dangerously.
Sergeant DeWitt, after a long bout with fever, died from causes unknown. Captain Ferguson telegraphed Washington and was informed that it might be as long as a month before a qualified telegrapher could be assigned to the post.
This is embarrassing. Is there a chance you can remain here until I get this new man assigned? I don't expect your service for nothing. I can authorize payment of $1 a day, retroactive to the day you began.
I can stay, and the pay isn't necessary. You're providing me with food and quarters, that's enough.
Nathan was enjoying his temporary duty, for the telegrapher at Fort Worth was liaison between Washington and the state of Texas, as well as parts of Indian Territory. Much information came his way. Despite the Reconstructionist governor of Texas refusing to recognize the Texas Rangers, the Rangers had survived and were now stronger than ever. The Union Army had developed a healthy respect for these men who had led the fight in the war with Mexico. Much of the information that came over the wire concerned outlaws of concern to Texas lawmen, and there were names of Rangers Nathan recognized. The last week in January, a report came in involving John Wesley Hardin. The gunman, in custody of two state lawmen, along with two other prisoners, was being transferred from the little town of Marshall, Texas, to Waco. While one of the guards had gone to buy grain for the horses, Hardin produced a hideout gun and shot the remaining guard. Hardin and the other prisoners had fled on horseback. One of the other prisoners captured with Hardin had been Dade Withers. Nathan was angry, for he was committed to fill in as post telegrapher for at least 3 more weeks, and maybe longer. His position now seemed a blessing and a curse. A blessing because he might have ridden for months searching saloons and reading newspapers before learning this bit of information that had fallen into his hands. However, he was cursed by being committed indefinitely to the very instrument that had served him so well, for he was unable to go look for Hardin and Withers. But he had one thing in his favor. With access to the telegraph, he could watch for reports on Withers and Hardin's whereabouts. Withers might not alone command the attention Hardin would, so it was to Nathan's advantage if Withers kept riding with Hardin. At last, Captain Ferguson received word that 3 newly assigned soldiers would be arriving on February 21st. One of them was the long-awaited telegrapher. The next report on Hardin came from South Texas, from Gonzales County. Hardin and some other riders had stopped at a Mexican camp, and after taking part in a game of Monte, quarreled with the dealer. Hardin slugged the man with his gun barrel, and when 2 other Mexicans drew knives, Hardin shot and wounded them. There was no mention of names other than Hardin's. On February 15th, word came that buffalo hunters had brought a wounded man to Fort Griffin. The men claimed they had been attacked by 4 riders, one of whom was believed to have been John Wesley Hardin, but that identification had been unconfirmed. Nathan went to the huge map of the United States in Captain Ferguson's office. Fort Griffin was in northwest Texas. That could mean Hardin and his friends were bound for Indian territory to hole up until it was safe to return to Texas, or it could mean they were going all the way to Kansas. Once back in his cabin, he told Mary they'd be leaving soon.
Where are we going when we leave here?
North. Maybe to Indian territory. Maybe to Kansas.
Am I allowed to know why?
I reckon. If you aim to ride with me, you might as well know what you're up against. I'm going to kill a man. He was one of seven who murdered my family.
Where are the others?
Dead. Now you know all there is to know about Nathan Stone. Are you satisfied?
No. What will you do after you've killed this last man?
I don't have the faintest idea.
On February 21st, Nathan gave up his temporary position as telegrapher, and Captain Ferguson wished him well.
I want to thank you. If you're ever in trouble and need the army, you call on us. However, we're always undermanned, so I can't promise there'll be enough of us to save you. Of course, you can always telegraph Washington.
I can't count on that either. Silver's the kind who'd go out and get himself shot just when I'm needing him the most.
Fort Griffin, Texas, February 25th, 1871. Nathan had a letter, enclosed in oilskin, from Captain Ferguson, informing any and all concerned that Nathan Stone had, on more than one occasion, rendered service to the Army of the United States of America. Ferguson had requested that Nathan be shown every consideration by other military installations, including food, lodging, and use of the telegraph. It quickly got Nathan and Mary into the office of Fort Griffin's post commander, Colonel Lowell.
Sorry, but the man you're seeking was released from our dispensary more than a week ago. His wound wasn't all that serious. The report we have of the shooting is sketchy because none of the buffalo hunters had ever seen Hardin. Therefore, we don't know if it was him or not. It well could have been because that's how most of these Texas killers operate. When the law gets after them in Texas, they go somewhere else. By the time they're in trouble there, things have usually cooled down enough for them to return here. We're never entirely rid of them until they're hung or shot.
Nathan and Mary were offered lodging and meals, so they spent one night at Fort Griffin. After breakfast, they rode north. Nathan had no doubt that he would be shot on sight if they rode anywhere close to Elgato's stronghold. Mary hadn't said anything, but he could see the fear in her eyes at the very mention of Indian territory. Finally, when they stopped to rest and water the horses, he decided to ease her mind.
We're not going anywhere near Elgato's place. It's a good 150 miles east of here. I think we'll just ride on to Fort Dodge. From there, I can telegraph Captain Ferguson to see if there's been any more hell-raising by Hardin anywhere in Texas.
I'm glad we're not going anywhere close to those outlaws. I don't even like to think of what Elgato would do to me if he ever got his hands on me again.
No more than he'd do to me. That's practically the first thing he said to me. That he'd kill me if I ever betrayed his trust.
I wonder what happened after you left them. Did they go ahead and rob the bank at Wichita?
I don't know. I haven't read a newspaper since leaving Kansas. In a way, I hope Hardin and his bunch are in Kansas. I have friends there, and it's a hell of a lot more civilized than Indian territory.
They crossed Indian Territory's panhandle and rode toward Fort Dodge. They were well received at the fort, but a telegraphed inquiry to Captain Ferguson at Fort Worth proved unrewarding, for there was no further word as to the whereabouts of John Wesley Hardin. After spending a night at the fort, Nathan and Mary rode upriver to the tent city. Many of the tents were gone, and in their places, wood-framed buildings now stood. The Mercantile was one such building and was quite impressive. It was larger than many Nathan had seen in bigger, already established towns. One display especially intrigued Nathan, for it was a new blasting method, a vast improvement over the bothersome, unpredictable black powder.
We can reach Hayes before dark. I know the Kansas Pacific dispatcher there, as well as the editor of the newspaper. I may learn something from him.
So they rode north. Nathan took a room in the same Hayes boarding house where he had once shared a room with Wild Bill Hickok. Cotton Blossom followed willingly only when they went out for meals, for he didn't like Hayes. It was late when they reached the town, and Nathan decided he would talk to Donaldson, the dispatcher, and Plato, the newspaper editor, the next day. However, he had been away from the saloons for months. Perhaps it was time to inquire there again.
I'm going to visit a few of the saloons and see what I can learn. I want you to stay here and keep Cotton Blossom with you.
He visited Drum's saloon first, finding it crowded but subdued. Others were much the same, and after less than 2 hours, Nathan was finished with them, having learned exactly nothing. He was afoot, and by the time he was inside of the boarding house, he knew something had happened. Men wandered around in front of the place. Pete Lanahan, the county sheriff, was there. When Nathan reached the outer fringes of the crowd, he discovered what the commotion was all about. Mary Holden knelt with her arms around a bloodied Cotton Blossom. The buttons had been ripped off Mary's shirt. A pair of soldiers, privates, stood within the circle of spectators. The trousers of one of them had been ripped from the knee down.
That's my dog, and I want to know what's happened here.
Nathan shoved his way through, coming face to face with Sheriff Lanahan. Lanahan didn't show any friendliness.
So it's your dog. You're prepared to pay the doctor bill then,
I'm prepared
you?
To call on the post commander at Fort Hayes and demand that these men be court-martialed. Look at the front of the girl's shirt.
Cotton Blossom bit him only after he did this. They beat him with a gun barrel.
That's enough. All of you clear out. I'm taking these men to jail and notifying the post commander. This will be handled in an orderly manner.
He turned back to Nathan.
Now, I want both of you at the courthouse in the morning at 9 o'clock. I need your names to file my report.
Nathan told him, and he left afoot, leading his horse, the pair of crestfallen soldiers plodding ahead of him. Nathan and Mary returned to their room, Cotton Blossom trotting beside them. Inside, Nathan removed a bottle of strong disinfectant from his pack. With a clean strip of cloth, he cleaned Cotton Blossom's wound and doused it with the fiery medicine.
I shouldn't have gone out, but I was only a short way from the door. It was like they were looking for someone.
Likely they were. There are few women in this town or in any other town on the frontier.
What's going to happen to the soldiers?
They'll do some time at hard labor. The post commander can't allow them to go unpunished.
But they didn't hurt me. It's Cotton Blossom that was hurt.
Now he'll live. He did what he thought was right.
The next morning, Nathan and Mary went to the courthouse. They did not see the two soldiers who had been charged. Mary left a deposition with the clerk, with the assurance it would be used at the hearing. Then, the pair of them went to the dispatcher's office.
Hey, you've come up in the world since leaving the old KP.
I'm surprised you've been able to keep any trains on the track without me out there.
It ain't been easy, son. I never knowed there were so many Indians with nothing to do except worry other folks.
Bud Donaldson had little to report, except that Wild Bill Hickok was in Colorado. Nathan had never visited Emmett Plato's newspaper office. Donaldson gave them directions, and it didn't take them long to find it. When they walked in, Plato virtually ignored them, fixing his eyes on Cotton Blossom, who clearly would have preferred to be somewhere else.
Ah, so this is the savage beast that single-handedly undermined the credibility of the United States Army.
He bit a soldier who wasn't minding his manners.
God, if he's here come next election, he could be the new sheriff.
I hear Hickok's in Colorado. What happened after he shot those two soldiers last July?
Well, one of the men died, and the other recovered. And there was talk about charging Wild Bill with murder, but there was some more trouble involving the military, and a civilian was killed. When it all came back to Hickok, he got out of it. The judge decided it was a Mexican standoff, being as much the fault of the soldiers as Hickok's. They were all drunk, and it wasn't Hickok that started the fight. If I had any say, I'd not build a fort anywhere close to a town, or a town anywhere close to a fort.
Plato had no other information of use to Nathan, so he and Mary rode out of Hayes, bound for Abilene. They were following the Kansas Pacific Track, and not more than 50 miles east of Hayes, they came upon the body of a Kansas Pacific outrider, Denton Valentine. He'd been shot in the back, twice.
Outlaws. There must be a train coming carrying an army payroll.
What are you gonna do?
See if I can find Denton's horse. He'll have a telegraph instrument in his saddlebag. Maybe I can stop the train.
They followed the tracks of the riderless horse, eventually finding the animal grazing beside a spring runoff. The telegraph instrument was in the saddlebag, but it was of no use. The telegraph line had been cut somewhere to the east. The line to Hayes was open, and Nathan quickly sent a message to Donaldson. Quickly, he placed the telegraph key in his own saddlebag and mounted his horse.
We have some riding to do. They've cut the telegraph line somewhere between here and Kansas City. I have to stop that train if I can.
Suppose we run into the robbers before we reach the train.
There'll be hell to pay. I'll look for them to try and stop the train somewhere between here and Abilene. We may not have time.
Nathan kicked his horse into a slow gallop, Mary following, and Cotton Blossom loping along behind. When they had stopped to rest the horses for a third time, Nathan put his ear to the rail.
The train's coming. Stay far behind me. Somewhere just ahead, the outlaws will be waiting, likely to blow up the track.
Please be careful.
Soon, Nathan could see the locomotive smoke against the sky. Far down the track, tiny figures were scurrying about. Nathan unshucked his Winchester, but he was too late to save the track. If he could get past the outlaws, Nathan might still be able to warn the trainmen. But the outlaws had seen him. A slug tore into his left side, the force of it almost driving him from the saddle. Grimly, he hung on as more lead hit him high in the chest. Ahead, through dimming vision, he could see the train, and it seemed to be slowing. Suddenly, the valiant black horse staggered and broke stride. He tried to turn on his belly to bring the Winchester into firing position, but his body refused. Somebody was firing from the train. Finally, he saw Mary's face, but just for a fleeting moment. Then he knew no more. What Nathan hadn't known was that while he had drawn the outlaws' fire, Mary Holden had ridden as near as she dared, desperately waving her sheepskin coat. The engineer had been able to stop the train. Thanks to a new railroad policy, half a dozen armed men had begun riding every train that carried an army payroll. Heavy fire from the train had driven the outlaws away, and now the railroad men concerned themselves with the fate of Nathan Stone.
I know him. He used to work for the KP.
Please, we must get him to a doctor.
We can't take him to Hayes, but we can reverse this train and take him back to Abilene. Some of you men let down a ramp and load the lady's horse and pack horse into a boxcar. Remove his saddle and saddlebags from the dead horse, too.
They rolled Nathan in his own blankets and placed him in the same boxcar into which they'd loaded the horses and Nathan's saddle.
I'll ride with him. Come on, Cotton Blossom.
The Kansas Pacific had built a depot of sorts, and when the telegrapher tested the line to Kansas City, he found it intact.
Contact Joel Netherton. Tell him Nathan Stone just saved him a train and an army payroll, not to mention our lives. There's a 3-day job for a section crew maybe 75 miles west of here.
The doctor brought his buckboard to the depot and with the help of the engineer, lifted Nathan from the boxcar into the buckboard.
I'm going with him wherever you're taking him.
To my house. We don't yet have a hospital.
Joel Netherton of the Kansas Pacific will be in touch with you. One of you men ride with the doc to help him unload. We're going to be here a while. I expect we'll be returning to Kansas City.
The doctor's name was Weber, Gerald Weber. His wife, Madeline, a thin, efficient woman, was his nurse.
Ma'am?
Mary.
Mary, then. He's in serious condition. Neither of the slugs exited, which means I'll have to dig him out. He's already lost a lot of blood, maybe too much. It's not going to be easy to watch. Perhaps you'd better wait in the parlor.
No. I'll stay with him, whatever happens.
Cotton Blossom sat outside in the doctor's yard. The railroad men, while they waited for orders from the dispatcher in Kansas City, led Mary's horse and Nathan's pack horse to the livery. Their saddles and the pack saddle were taken inside the Kansas Pacific Depot. For 2 hours, Dr. Weber worked over Nathan. Finally, he rinsed away the blood and disinfected and bandaged the wounds.
I can't do more than give him a fighting chance. He lost a lot of blood before I got to him, and he lost more while I was probing for the lead. Neither slug struck any vital organs or bones, and that's in his favor, but it's been a severe shock. If he's alive this time tomorrow, I'd say he'll make it. He'll need to remain here tonight, and possibly tomorrow night. The rest of the way, he'll be fighting infection.
I'm staying with him then, no matter how long.
Then I'll have Madeline set up a cot for you in here. I'll be looking in on him several times during the night.
4 days later, the doctor declared Nathan out of danger. He was then taken to the hotel, and it was there that Joel Netherton of the Kansas Pacific came to see him.
I'm pleased to see you again, although I'd like the circumstances to be different.
So would I.
I have good news for you. The Kansas Pacific has authorized me to pay you a reward of $1,000 and to pay all your medical expenses and your lodging here at the hotel until you're back on your feet.
Well, that's mighty generous. I'm obliged.
Well, we're in your debt. All we're out is the repair of a piece of track. But for you, we might have lost a train, its crew, and an army payroll.
You're having considerable trouble with train robbers, then.
Yes. We believe these robbers you intercepted are the same ones who've dogged us for months. A sheriff's posse once picked up their trail just south of here, but lost it when they escaped into Indian territory.
10 or 11 riders?
11, as a matter of fact. How did you know?
I think I know who they are and where they are.
Great Scott! When you're feeling up to it, will you share that information with railroad authorities?
I reckon, but it'll be a fight to the death.
When Netherton had excused himself, Mary looked at Nathan long and hard.
You're not thinking of leading a posse into Indian territory, are you?
I haven't thought about it one way or the other, but don't you think the world would be a better place without that bunch of gun-toting varmints?
Yes, but why does it have to be you who rids the world of them? I want you alive. Doesn't it matter to you what I want?
Well, you know it does, but you also know the kind of hombre I am. That I won't cash in my chips sitting in a rocker before the fire with you holding my hand.
Yes, you'll go out in a hail of bullets, doing your damnedest to take as many with you as you can. I just want to put it off as long as possible.
So do I.
The wounds had taken more out of Nathan than he believed, for it was the first week in June before he began to feel like himself. The doctor advised another month of rest, and the next time he saw Netherton, the railroad man encouraged it.
We're having a big celebration on July 4th, and I want you and Mary there. There'll be brass from Washington, railroad officials, all the beer you can drink, speeches.
Oh, no, you don't. Shooting outlaws, yes. Speeches, no.
Whoa, you unjustly accuse me.
I've heard of these hog killings where a bunch of hombres talk with nobody caring a damn what they say. I'll be there on one condition, that I can leave when I'm good and ready.
Well, that's how it'll be then.
Kansas City, Missouri, June 20th, 1871. The Kansas Pacific offered transportation from Abilene to Kansas City, but Nathan wanted to ride. It was a good time to buy horses in Abilene, for many a cattleman sold his remuda at Trail's End. Nathan still mourned the loss of his faithful black, and made up his mind never to own another black, for it would be a constant reminder of the one that could never truly be replaced. He finally settled for a Gruya, almost the exact shade of gray as Mary's. They reached Kansas City, and when Nathan presented Mary to Eppie Bolivar, she welcomed the girl without question. They settled in at Eppie's boarding house, and Nathan resumed his habit of reading newspapers from other towns, forever seeking a name that was never there. What had become of John Wesley Hardin and the men who rode with him? A week before the affair on July 4th, Netherton's wife took Mary into town and outfitted her in what was considered proper dress for the time. The fun began when she returned and spent an hour getting herself up for Nathan's approval. It was a ballroom dress that almost swept the floor with what seemed a never-ending array of petticoats. Her slippers were matching light blue. She came out almost falling over the numerous petticoats.
What's so funny? Would you rather I wore a flannel shirt and Levi's?
There'd be less a chance of you falling and breaking your neck. I'm wearing what I always wear, or I don't go.
But Nathan yielded to pressure, some of it from Mary, and eventually bought new black pinstripe trousers, a white ruffled shirt, string tie, black boots, and a new high-crowned gray hat.
Damn it, a man walks around dressed for burying and he's likely to be shot just on general principles.
But the affair was deemed a huge success. Nathan enjoyed it far more than he expected to or would later admit. Byron Silver was there, and while much of his and Nathan's joint efforts could not be discussed, they had their moments.
I reckon we'd best enjoy this blowout. It's the first time we've even been together for any length of time that one or both of us wasn't being shot at.
Yeah, I miss it, don't you?
Silver remained in Kansas City for 2 more days before returning to Washington. Finally, on July 8th, Nathan hit pay dirt with his newspapers. On July 6th, in Abilene, Charles Cougar had been shot dead after a quarrel with John Wesley Hardin. Another piece charged Hardin with killing Juan Videno, a Mexican, in the tiny village of Bluff City, Kansas. There was no mention of the men who had supposedly left Texas with Hardin. The writer of one of the articles had suggested that Hardin had come up the trail with the Texas herd to Wichita, but that was unconfirmed. The trail drive story made sense to Nathan, accounting for the time it had taken Hardin to reach Kansas.
I'm riding to Wichita. You can stay here if you want. There's a chance the man I'm after came up the trail from Texas with the Texas herd.
And if he didn't, you'll be off on another trail and I may never see you again. I'll go with you.
Wichita, Kansas, July 11th, 1871. Nathan made the rounds of all the saloons without learning anything that was helpful to him. But his luck turned completely around when he reached a less-than-elegant hotel called the Texas.
I've been looking for some hombres to get here for 3 months. They were coming up the trail with a herd, and I'd say if they got here, it was on maybe the 4th or the 5th.
The clerk allowed him to look at the register. Nathan started on July 3rd, and on the next page found what he was seeking. The scrawled signature read J.W. Hardin, and on the line below it, D. Withers.
They may not be in Wichita, but they're somewhere in Kansas.
You can't be sure of that. It's not more than 40 miles from here to Indian Territory.
Well, after Hardin left here, he went to Bluff City. From there, he had to ride to Abilene. What I need to know is whether or not Dade Withers is with him. If Withers is on his own, then the hell with Hardin. I've been trailing him because he's been my only contact with Withers.
Abilene, Kansas, July 12th, 1871. Nathan found no record of John Wesley Hardin at any of the hotels, and when he was about to admit defeat, he found Withers' scrawled signature in an out-of-the-way hotel register. The date was July 9th.
By God, that's what I've been looking for. Withers was still in Abilene 2 days after Hardin killed the second man. That means that Withers is no longer riding with Hardin.
Is that going to make him any easier to find?
Yes. I don't know. It means Withers has kept his nose clean enough to sign his own name. I'm going to at least ask the livery. His horse may have a Texas brand.
Nathan spoke to the liveryman, and he learned that the man had recently seen a horse with a brand from Texas, the XIT brand.
That's no help?
My God, no. The XIT is likely the biggest damn spread in the world. Covers 10 counties. That's what XIT means, 10 in Texas. I doubt there's a cowboy west of the Mississippi who hasn't ridden for XIT.
You don't have to talk to me like I'm a dumb cow. I've never been anywhere until I met you.
Sorry, I keep forgetting that.
You know Withers isn't here because the date on that hotel register was July 9th, unless he stayed somewhere else for a longer time.
That makes no sense. If I stay at a hotel for one night, why the hell wouldn't I stay there till I was ready to leave town?
I don't know. We're talking about Dade Withers, not you.
You're right. It makes no sense. I can't ride on without knowing for sure.
Nathan studied as many hotel registers as he was permitted to see and didn't find Withers' signature again.
Now where are we going?
He could have ridden to Hayes, Dodge, or even Denver. We'll try Dodge first and then Hayes. If I don't find him in either place, then I reckon we'll ride farther north.
If you find no further trace of him in Kansas, how do you know he didn't just ride back to Texas?
Speechless, Nathan leaned on his saddle and rubbed his eyes. Why did a woman always have to be so right? In Texas, riding with John Wesley Hardin, Dade Withers had taken part in several robberies. While nobody had been killed, Withers had welcomed Hardin's decision to join the trail drive bound for Wichita. Withers had been drawn to the Texas outlaw because of Hardin's lightning-fast draw and his devil-may-care attitude. But while crossing Indian territory with the trail drive, Hardin had shot and killed an Indian without cause. Withers realized that Hardin had a hell of a temper, and he killed for any reason or for no reason at all. Withers had thus reached the sobering conclusion that just riding with such a man could get him gunned down or hanged on the same limb as Hardin. When he had reached Kansas, Withers had just begun to breathe a little easier when, in the space of just 2 days, Hardin had killed 2 more men. Arden had been forced to leave town in a hurry, so it hadn't been difficult for Dade Withers to sever his ties with the outlaw. Now, Withers was riding southwest, for he had heard of the lawless tent city on the bank of the Arkansas, soon to become Dodge City. Withers didn't bother stopping at Fort Dodge, but rode 8 miles west, where he paid for a cot in the tent that was soon to become a hotel. Withers then spent the rest of the day sizing up various businesses. Most of them, except for the mercantile, still occupied tents. He quickly decided the mercantile was his best bet for some fast money, for thanks to the soldiers and civilians at Fort Dodge, it did a landslide business. While in Wichita, Withers had seen a map of the state, and he judged that on a fast horse he was less than an hour from Indian territory. He could be well on his way before the marshal took the trail, if he even bothered to. But Dade Withers would have hurriedly scrapped his plan to rob the store had he known that others were of the same mind. Breed and Venardo had already spent half a day in the tent city, and even as Withers settled down on his cot for the night, the two renegades rode south, bound for Indian territory. Their report would bring El Gato and his outlaw band to the tent city the next evening, just after dark. The new mercantile had prospered, and the vultures had begun to gather. Unsure as to where he should ride next, Nathan had chosen Fort Dodge in hopes he could avoid Hayes. Mary had been quiet since leaving Abilene, and Nathan decided to break the lengthy silence.
If these forts ever come up to strength, I reckon we'll end up sleeping on the ground. No more vacant officers' quarters.
Maybe by then you won't be riding all over the frontier. What would it take to get you to settle down in one place?
I don't know. Do you want me settled down in one place?
It would be nice, when you have a son or a daughter.
What? Are you?
Not yet. But how would you feel if I were?
I reckon I'd be proud. God knows I've done little else in which I can take pride.
Fort Dodge, Kansas, July 15, 1871. Dade Withers waited until supper time before entering the mercantile, for when one clerk went to eat, the other would be alone in the store. Withers entered the mercantile, browsing until the first clerk had gone, then waiting impatiently until the last customer departed. Only then did he approach the counter. When the clerk looked up, he found himself facing a masked man with a cocked Colt revolver.
Put the money in this sack, and you won't be hurt.
Quickly, the clerk complied, and while there were many bills, it seemed to Withers they were mostly of small denomination.
The rest of it. The gold, too.
It was Monday, following a busy weekend, and the nervous clerk had hoped to get off as easily as he could by sacking only the paper money. But now he began piling handfuls of double eagles into the sack. Finally, he held up his hands.
That's all.
The man nodded quickly. Withers grabbed the sack and, holding the Colt steady on the clerk, began backing toward the door. Already the sun had slid below the western horizon, with purple shadows announcing the coming of darkness. Before the angry clerk could cut loose again, Withers was mounted and galloping away. He removed his bandana from his face. He felt like shouting, for he had pulled it off without firing a shot, and he didn't have to share it with anyone else. At least that's what he thought. But circumstances changed quickly. Comfortable with the shielding darkness, he slowed his horse to a walk, only to find himself surrounded by horsemen. Even in starlight, there was no mistaking the muzzles of revolvers. They could kill him 10 times over.
I admire an ambitious man, senor. But not when his ambition robs me of what is mine. You will come with me as my guest, and we shall discuss your future.
Damn you! I don't take orders from you!
It is that, senor, or I will kill you. The choice is yours.
I'm riding with you.
Nathan and Mary went directly to Fort Dodge, arriving the day after Dade Withers had robbed the store. The post commander, Lieutenant Colonel Hatton, knew Captain Ferguson well, and Hatton had been impressed with Ferguson's letter of recommendation. He was cordial as Nathan and Mary were shown into his office. Without going into detail, Nathan told Hatton of his search for the outlaw John Wesley Hardin and of the trail that had played out after Hardin's gunplay at Abilene.
I don't know if this fits in or not, but yesterday at dark, a lone gunman robbed the mercantile at Tent City. Marshal Summerfield investigated last night. Tell him I've authorized the release of information he may have, and you may want to talk to the men at the store.
I'm obliged, sir. May we impose on your hospitality for the night?
You may, and welcome. The corporal will show you to your quarters. See me again before you leave the post.
Nathan left Mary and Cotton Blossom in the cabin that Hatton had assigned them and went looking for U.S. Marshal Jed Summerfield. Nathan didn't like the man, but he had jurisdiction over all of western Kansas and went out of his way to see that nobody forgot.
One man, masked, entered the store just at dark and escaped with a large amount of gold and paper currency. That's all I can tell you.
The robber must have left a trail. Which way did he go after leaving the store?
Toward Indian territory.
Did you trail him, or do you just feel pretty strong that he headed for the territory?
Mister, when you're in hollering distance of the territory, you don't have to watch a robber ride over the line to know he's there.
And for all you know, he could have spent the night on the prairie within sight of the fort.
I reckon he could have. I'm just one man, by God. Suppose you just ride out there and bring him in. When you do, I'll hand you this 10 star and tell you where to stick it.